I call my channel Alien Perspective because I like to think I have a degree of detachment, and it's more that I hate the ideas. If you want to get into what made me fascinated by political psychology, I just looked at the history. Every policy position that I have is based on what maximizes freedom and human well-being, and conservatives are diametrically opposed to that.
I think a lot of people's eyebrows just went up because I think there's a big leap between saying someone's misguided or they have the wrong opinions or they're doing stuff that's harmful and then but making that leap into they have a psychological problem.
I think that one of the things about autism for me is that a lot of people, almost everyone when they grow up, they have these cultural assumptions. The American dream is real. Any sort of religious assumptions that people make, any sort of like gendered assumptions that people make. And one of the things about autism is I just feel like I'm an alien. I just feel like I was born on another planet.
Welcome to another episode of Tilting at Windmills. I'm Mike Donahue, and today we're fortunate enough to be joined by Keegan Tatum, who, besides having a master's in political science from Columbia, not the worst university in the world, is now going under a title. What can I say is your real title, Keegan? There's the catch-all title of creator, but that might be a little bit too wide. How would you describe yourself?
I just say that I make videos. I make videos on YouTube, and I make videos on TikTok, and I am an expert in political psychology.
And why are you an expert in political psychology?
Unfortunately, you already mentioned the master's, so I don't feel like I have to brag about that. I think when I was at Columbia, one of my focuses was political psychology. Frankly, it was the thing I put the most energy and passion and effort into. And as important to me as that education is, since then, I have continued to read dozens and dozens of academic research papers regarding political psychology, in particular the neurological personality and overall psychological differences between people on the left and people on the right.
Great. You're qualified. I guess one thing that kind of came through on the videos, and I don't want to overstate this or misrepresent it, but you really don't like conservative people. And maybe that's not the right way of phrasing it. I think there was a number of things where you're intertwining the psychology of conservatism, and you discussed potential brain damage, just low overall IQ, lack of education, lack of sexual something. And I think this was your old people can become conservative thing. I definitely am in the camp where I don't think we should pussyfoot around these guys, but do you feel anything about that and that sort of harder edge stance that most liberals would take?
Yeah, so I get why people who watch my videos would think that I'm like hating on people. I don't think of it that way. I call my channel Alien Perspective because I like to think I have a degree of detachment. And it's more that I hate the ideas. If you want to get into what made me fascinated by political psychology, I just looked at the history in this country. What did conservatives believe at any given time? What did liberals believe at any given time? And what did the radicals believe at any given time? And a very clear pattern emerged that conservative ideas just hurt people. And I don't like that. My goal overall with politics, every policy position that I have is based on what maximizes freedom and human well-being. And conservatives are diametrically opposed to that. They might not see that internally, but the policies that they support have those outcomes. So it's more about I don't like the ideas than it is that I don't like the people.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So you would describe yourself as a socialist?
Yes. I'm a leftist, a socialist, democratic socialist. There's a lot of different things that I could be called that are accurate. You could call me a progressive. That would also be accurate.
No, I'm just trying to, there's constant refrain, and in fact, I just saw a video on it today about the author's point or the creator's point was, did we learn nothing from 2016 in terms of making fun of Republicans? So what would you say to that sort of, we have to be nice to them, we have to try to understand them, we have to try to realize where they're coming from, we have to try and win them over to our side?
So I'm very much of the belief that we should try everything, right? And should we do electoralism? Should we do unions? Well, we should do everything. And when it comes to trying to convince as many conservatives as possible, it's just straight up true that the best way of convincing people is by being friends with them, by showing them empathy and compassion. I've watched people who were formerly Nazis, who were formerly KKK members, and how did they become not that anymore? And it was because somebody that they didn't expect showed them compassion and niceness. Now, my thinking with my channel is I can't do that because I'm not in face-to-face contact with these people. Because like I said, the best thing is to be friends with them, to have people in your social circle that you trust, that you like, that have different ideas. And that is what really opens up people. Whereas what I feel like I'm trying to do is basically show that conservative ideas come from a bad set of psychological tendencies in order to discredit them as a whole. Because whether it's being supportive of slavery, conservatives were the pro-segregation people. They've opposed every expansion of voting rights in American history. They've expanded every expansion in women's rights in American history. And I go on and on, workers' rights, gay rights, trans rights. And so there must be some sort of psychological problem that's causing these people to have bad and destructive ideas. And I don't see anyone else talking about this. So I feel like that's where I step up.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people's eyebrows just went up because I think there's a big leap between saying someone's misguided or they have the wrong opinions or they're doing stuff that's harmful to the general overall. But making that leap into they have a psychological problem. Mm-hmm. Or do you really feel like it's a true, because what you're talking about, and I know you also talked about if you're young, you're not a liberal, you're an idiot. And if you're old and not a conservative, you have no heart. That tired refrain.
Yeah, I made a whole video trying to debunk that. But
that the whole age separation and the split between older people shifting conservative, younger people shifting liberal, that's been going on for centuries. And I guess I would suggest, isn't it maybe that's really just more of people wanting to keep the status quo versus people who want to change the status quo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's the kind of like broad view of the difference between progressives and conservatives. But conservatives want change. They wanted Roe v. Wade overturned. That was a change. I see the fundamental difference between the right and the left as being hierarchy, as being concentration of power. People on the right want a greater concentration of power. In America, that's concentrated power in the hands of rich people, of business owners, of white people, of men, of straight people, and of Christians. And people on the left want a more egalitarian distribution of power. When it comes to people over time, like individuals over time becoming more conservative over time, I think that trend is largely overrated. There's about a net 10% swing towards conservatives, which is some noticeable. A 55-45 election in the United States is a safe election. Like the last time there was a 55%, 45% victory in the presidential election was before I was born. It was like 40 years ago. So I don't want to underrate 10%, but I also don't want to overrate how much people become more conservative as they age.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm really nervous. This is my first ever appearance on another podcast or show. So I'm like, I'm both very nervous, but also like I'm living in a moment that I will remember for the rest of my life. So this is very special. I really appreciate being invited on, Mike.
Thanks for the pressure. No pressure, just a lasting memory.
It's a good one thus far.
But if we talk, and so I don't know if you want to delve into that, but you make no secret of the fact that you're diagnosed autistic. Do you want to talk about how that sort of influenced you and the impact that's had?
Mm-hmm. So I think that one of the things about autism for me is that a lot of people, almost everyone, when they grow up, they have these cultural assumptions. The American dream is real. Any sort of religious assumptions that people make, any sort of like gendered assumptions that people make. And one of the things about autism is I just feel like I'm an alien. I just feel like I was born on another planet. And a big reason is because I just didn't get that cultural assumptions download. I at least like to think, and maybe this is self-serving egotism, but I like to think that actually makes me a little bit better at looking at politics because I can have that kind of almost detached third-person perspective view. When I was in high school and I had my political awakening, I would tell people like, hey, imagine if you were an alien and you looked at the American healthcare system and like tens of thousands of people are dying every year and yet we're the richest country ever. Imagine if aliens, like how would they judge us? And the point I was trying to get across was, wow, this is a messed up system. I would say that the lack of cultural assumptions, or at least less cultural assumptions, is the way that my autism affects my view of politics the most. And I've had people comment that for them, it also gives them like a greater sense of empathy, and that it gives them a stronger sense of justice. And perhaps that's true of me. I know it's true of other people.
Okay. I don't know much about the subject, so I'm going to refrain, but I think it's a positive trait to be open about that and talk to relay your own lived experiences. In terms of the aliens coming down and seeing the healthcare system, is that more of a judgment or a reflection of conservative dominance or conservative power versus just capitalism? And do you intertwine capitalism and conservatism at a fundamental level?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I want to answer that last one first. Okay, so no, it is now. Like, we can't be too absorbed in right now, because at the beginning of capitalism, a few hundred years ago when capitalism first started going, it was actually the radicals and the liberals who were pro-capitalism, and it was the conservatives who were pro-feudalism, because feudalism was the system that already existed. So you could say they were conservative because they wanted to conserve feudalism, but it also, how do I put this? One of the fundamental things about conservatism is thinking that certain people are just better than other people. And under feudalism, the feudal lord is ordained by God to be superior to the peasants. And that was the assumption in throughout Europe and anywhere else that had feudalism. Japan would be the other one. What was your other question? Please remind me.
No, just talking about whether our current healthcare system in America, which is obviously just broken, is that more of a result of conservative power and conservative ideals, or is that more of a judgment on just being, we're a capitalist, hyper-capitalist nation?
I don't want to put all the blame on conservatives for this one. Liberals, and by liberals, I mean, because progressives fit under the liberal category, but I'm talking specifically of the more conservative Democrats. Like, they aren't for single-payer universal healthcare either. And I'm not just talking about the politicians. I'm talking about the voters, too. We had an opportunity to have Bernie Sanders, and there was a strong generational divide between who voted for Bernie Sanders, who voted for Hillary Clinton / Joe Biden. So it's not just conservatives. Like, oh, unions too. Unions back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s also opposed universal healthcare, because one of the ways that they would try to represent their workers is to try to get better healthcare. And they saw it as like a selling point of the union. So yes, conservatives are the main opposition, but I don't want to put all the blame on them. It is obviously a capitalist thing, and it is also obviously just momentum. You know, so much of politics is guided by momentum, and change is hard, especially in our system with the way that the Congress is elected, for example. And the moneyed interests is the number one reason. The moneyed interests don't want it to happen, and they have completely bought off the Republican Party. That's been the case for over 100 years. And they bought off enough Democrats to make it so that's just not going to happen. And as with everything, you have to blame media as well for not properly educating people that, according to a Yale study, Medicare for All would save 70,000 lives every year. That is 250,000 people every presidential term. That is stunningly high number of people. And it would save trillions of dollars every decade. The media has failed to properly educate people. And so a lot of people just don't know that.
So the media gets a lot of stick for a lot of things. I think I probably tend to be more of the opinion that the media is really just simply a reflection of the cultural desires. They're, at the end of the day, they want numbers. They are going to put stuff to bleeds, leads, all that stuff, the angry talking heads. I just don't think I understand your point about the lack of media education, but no one would watch it.
That is the assumption with media. I also have a broadcast journalism degree from Syracuse, and it's interesting how the culture of media is even all the way down to journalism school. It's really amazing. And you're so right. It is mostly about profit. And we have to consider that every television channel with, you know, Fox News, NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN, who's watching them, right? They want to please their audience. They want to get eyeballs. And whether it's right or not, their assumption is that their audience is more conservative, certainly than the younger generation. That's just true. But I will never forget, we had the head of NBC come for a talk at Syracuse. And he basically said that they don't do science stuff, they don't do smart stuff, because they don't think that their viewers have the attention span to follow it. And whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it's a pretty negative assumption of their audience. I like to think a little bit better of their audience, but that is their assumption. And hey, they're making a lot more money than I am, so maybe they're right.
But is it, in terms of percentage of funnel, is it their fault really, because that they're not really doing that? Isn't it ultimately rely on just the sort of basic human nature that we're just not interested in complex subjects as a general rule?
I don't know. I don't know to what extent people need to be introduced to complex subjects in order to get an acquired taste for them. I don't know. I like to assume that my audience can handle the complicated stuff. That's the fun stuff for me. And I can't be alone.
No, but certainly not enough for a cable company to make a profit.
Perhaps not. No, perhaps not. By the way, your basic assumption that there's, like, media isn't insidious. It's like, they're not, like, out, maybe other than Fox News, which knowingly lies to their audience. But outside of that, they're not like, we're going to stop them from liking Medicare for All. Because they are very reactive.
Okay. I'm still just struggling with conception or sort of the point of the conservatism and conservative ideals, that rather than just being, this is human nature, this is a cycle, this has ever, thus it shall be, so on and so forth, that it's not fully that there is something intrinsically wrong with the people that go conservative.
Okay. Yeah, let me try to answer that. Zero denial that conservatism is a part of human nature. I don't think I could rebuke a denial anymore. I suppose I see a lot of conservatism as not quite evolved enough. Conservatism is more based in fear. It's more based in reactivity. There has been a study that I cite in my videos that shows that low effort thought correlates with conservative views. In other words, just not thinking things through, mental laziness. One of the things that makes people more liberal is thinking in a more nuanced, complex way. There was a study I read just the other week about how the experimenters were able to get people to be less prejudiced just by making them think things through. And the way that you make somebody who is on the left more conservative is by making them feel threatened. And I think that tells you so much of the difference between the left and the right. I've gotten comments about how, well, we must have evolved both liberals and conservatives. And I remember thinking this 10 years ago. It's easy to think this. Hey, listen, we need progressives to lead on new ideas, and we need conservatives to say, whoa, not so fast. You know, the liberal wants to try the new berries on the bush, and the conservative says, wait, they might be poisoned. But if that were the case, then conservatives would have stopped bad ideas from being implemented. And that's not really the pattern we see.
But they're only bad to you.
Yes, that is true. Based off of my values and my principles of maximizing human freedom and human well-being and stopping a change, we mentioned Medicare for All. If we had Medicare for All, that would save 70,000 lives and it would save a bunch of money. And it would give people more freedom to be able to go to the doctor when they feel like they have a problem. So many Americans don't go to the doctor when they have a problem, and then it festers and it gets worse. And I would say stopping that is bad. It is my opinion that's bad, because I value human life over the profits of large corporations.
So what do you think their mentality is, the people who really strenuously fight against Medicare for All? I think a conservative would not attribute any of those thoughts to why they don't want Medicare for All. They would first and foremost point to the big government and just say, look, mm-hmm. This is big government. Do you really want our government taking out your kidney or whatever? That's going to be their sort of answer. Yeah. What do you say when they come up with reasons like that? I can understand why someone could argue that point, even though I'm
being opposed. Oh, yeah. Sorry for interrupting. But no. If they're afraid of authoritarianism, I'm right there with them. I think authoritarianism is one of the most evil forces that hurts our species. And that has been the case throughout human history. But if single-payer healthcare led to horrible authoritarianism, we would have seen it in any of the countries where that happened. So I think what it is, it's a fear of change that is unambiguously part of the conservative psychology. Conservatives in general, hold on, I'm trying to think about how I want to say this.
Because I might even target, like, Russia was not as communist as it was authoritarian. Like, when I think of communist Russia and Lenin, Stalin, etc., to me, those are authoritarian regimes.
Absolutely.
Right. I think Mussolini had free healthcare, right? And the trains ran on time.
That's an overrated stereotype. I learned that the trains didn't actually run as on time as we think. But to your point, yes, a Soviet I hate even calling it the Soviet Union. I think that's like a propaganda term. They were an empire. Ask people in Hungary when they rolled the tanks in whether it was a union or not. Ask the people of Ukraine whether it was a union or not. The Soviet Empire was a horrible right-wing dictatorship. But in the Soviet Union, it's not, they got the free healthcare and then they became authoritarian. It's like that, it just, one does not lead to the other. One of the things you'll notice with a lot of conservative arguments is slippery slope is so common. And it's not what history shows. We just don't have that kind of slippery slope.
And I think a perfect example of that is when gay rights were really starting to make some progress in the country, especially the gay marriage.
You haven't felt the end of Western civilization now that gay people can marry?
I can remember very clearly many Republicans, many real established Republicans coming out or making comments or alluding to the thought, oh, if gay guys can marry or gay women can marry, I can marry my dog or I can marry my horse, or and just bringing these completely nonsensical things in as trying to, again, create that sense of fear or distaste from their followers.
Mm-hmm. I would add to it, this is what I've been thinking about a little bit recently, is to what extent is this just us bullshitting ourselves? Can I curse on your show? Is that okay?
Yeah,
okay. I wonder to what extent transphobes, do they really believe the stuff that they're saying, like the really crazy stuff that they're saying? Or is it a way of bullshitting themselves? Because ultimately, homophobia and transphobia, the base is an oversensitivity to disgust. There have been neurological scans. The brains of conservatives, the brains of liberals. And they have shown that conservatives have more gray matter in the amygdala. And when you say the amygdala, most people think, oh yeah, that's the part of the brain that deals with fear. It also deals with disgust. And conservatives have been shown in repeated studies to have an oversensitivity to disgust. And it's just a fact that this is the source of homophobia and transphobia. To what extent is them using a biblical justification just them BSing themselves? Because come on, you're clamping down on people's freedom. You're clamping down on people's freedom of expression. What's more American than freedom of expression?
I can think of a couple of things.
I think in a good way.
Part of it's reactionary, right? I think,
yes.
Because again, this goes back to the conservative-liberal push-pull scenario, right? So liberals are pushing and conservatives are just saying, hey, let's not eat the berries just yet. Have Freddy. Let's see what happens to Fred. But Fred.
I like the idea that Fred has lasted as a name for tens of thousands of years.
Could happen. Single syllable. Anyway, but that normal inherent pushback, and I think, again, trying to get myself in the mind of them, is that when you start saying that you're transphobic, or comments that most people would think is what they consider to be just common sense, then it becomes an us versus them kind of thing.
Yes.
Maybe,
Sorry. I just want to double down on what you're saying. Basically, they just see it as name calling. And when you feel like you're being name called, you ain't going to be open to the other person's ideas.
But how many, for the Obama election, if you don't like Obama, you're racist. If you don't like Hillary, you're a misogynist.
Yeah, I've never been a fan of these arguments. It is true that one of two of the leading motivations for people to vote for Republicans and Donald Trump is sexism and racism. There's no doubt about it. But saying if you don't vote for one of my candidates, then you're a bigot. No, there's plenty of Republicans who do it just for the tax cuts. And now, does voting for Trump have racist outcomes? Yeah, it does. But they're not voting necessarily for the racism. They might be just doing it for some selfish financial reason.
Or they're afraid.
Or they're afraid, yeah.
Yeah, based on what they've been being fed. It's interesting to me when I talk to my conservative friends and they go on and on about Biden being senile and dementia. And I'm like, have you listened to Trump lately? Have you heard the words that are coming out of his mouth? There's
no, the answer is no,
and they haven't. They don't see it. They just literally don't see it. They only see the very 10-second clip of him being sentient at the beginning.
Yeah. Oh my God. Can I build on this idea?
Yes.
Yeah, because like we were talking about with the media, there's no profit for Fox News or One America News or Ben Shapiro in showing the like just deranged Trump clips. There's no profit for them in that. They already saw, Fox News especially, what happens to their audience and their numbers when they tell the truth. For example, Fox News initially admitted that Biden won the election. They suffered in the numbers, and then they changed their tune.
But they've lost a portion of the audience and never getting back to OAN and other sort of more, even more right-wing media.
What good, I root for the downfall of Fox News.
I think in history, I think there's going to be a few seminal figures that have shaped our century. Roger Ailes among them, yes. Mitch McConnell.
Rush Limbaugh.
Among them, Rush Limbaugh among them. I don't know that I necessarily want to get into your low effort thinking, because I do think in general, people prefer low effort ideas.
There's, yes.
If I can see something on the surface, and maybe there's something beneath the surface, I'm not going to expend the extra energy to go digging, right? I'm just going to, okay, take it on face value, and I'm being told this, so I'm going to accept it.
Yeah, and it's hard to blame people because, man, people are busy, man. You get, the average American worker, doesn't they work more than 40 hours a week? You got kids, that's a ton of work already. I feel part of me is this is important. Politics is important. You need to devote time and energy to understand this stuff. But also, I get it. A lot of people don't even see politics affecting their lives anyway. It's hard to blame people, but there is a difference in terms of how much thought people put into it. Conservatives are measurably more mentally lazy. And you can see this in their ideas. Let me think of an example.
Building a wall in the middle of a desert?
Building a wall. Yeah, if you think about it, there's packed explosives. You know, a big wall couldn't keep out the Mongols, and we got C4 right now. So come on, people. A big wall, that ain't going to work. We have ladders, yeah. Your face right now, it's so great.
But this is the point over and over again. The fear of the migrant, like the Mongolian hordes, right?
Yep.
Coming in and sweeping and, you know, raping the men and killing the women, whatever it was. Like, this is the subtext, I think, of what Fox pushes.
Yes, and there is just this innate tribalist fear that people have of people that are different. And you want to get into the psychological differences? That's just more prevalent within conservatives. But I don't want to pretend like we on the left don't have any of that either. I was just reading a study yesterday, actually, that just pertains to the reaction mechanism in our brain. And then there's the regulatory system where it's, okay, is this an unreasonable reaction? Is this a socially undesirable reaction? Does this reaction conflict with our preconceived notions? And that regulatory system is actually stronger in people on the left than it is on people on the right. You know, when it comes to racism, for example, if you grow up in a white supremacist society like the United States, everyone is prone to a certain degree of racism. I'm really sorry. We are all prone to it. Sure. We can be as anti-racist as possible, but we are all prone to that kind of bias. It's just the people on the left are a little bit better at regulating it than people on the right.
So I think the other place where I get nervous talking to you is about when we abstract or continue past the psychology of the situation into actual sort of physical differences, being either cranial or hormonal or whatever.
I'd love to address this. Yes. I do not want my work to be taken in a conservatives are inherently inferior direction that never leads in a good direction. When you have supremacist views, that always leads to destruction and misery. One of the things I want to get across is like, our minds are not static. Our brains are not static. we have power over them. And think of your brain as like a muscle. The reason why conservatives have a measurably larger amygdala, as far as I can tell, and this is my opinion, this is just my opinion, is because that part of their brain just gets used more. So it gets exercised more. So it's more active and it's larger. And one of the points I really want to get across is that we can exercise our brain in different directions. We are not beholden to our biology. Nobody is inherently inferior. You just don't have to have the bad ideas. Please just don't have the bad ideas.
Easier said than done. So you're saying that the physiology can be a byproduct of just the surface level or the surface level ideas. It's just the neuron pathways are either forming or not forming in certain directions.
So I think about it in terms of causal arrows, okay? Having a more active amygdala makes you more afraid, makes you more right-wing, but also engaging with Fox News, right-wing media, thinking in right-wing ways reinforces the amygdala's being active. Oh, that was poorly said, but you get the point that I'm trying to say. So the causal arrow works both directions.
So let me throw out another sort of hypothesis in terms of the differentiation and why people tend to split or diverge. I find, again, this is stereotyping on a massive scale. The conservative friends I know are very black and white. Black and white, yes. Right and wrong, this or that, right?
Yeah.
And the liberals I know, I think honestly, just the discussion that we have, they're much more gray area. There's a bunch of different possibilities. Am I right? Am I not right?
You are spot on 100%. That is what the data shows. That's what the political psychology literature shows. That literally just making conservatives think in a more nuanced way makes them less conservative and less prejudiced.
So let me try and tie that back to religion, which is going to be really tricky. Because in religion, and this argument does come up, the people who are black and white, so I don't know if conservatives are religious because of this or religious people are conservative. I don't know which way the direction it goes, but
I think it's both.
There is this sort of, I'm getting my morals from an external source. It's not me. I don't have to think about it. I know what I'm told to do. This is right. This is wrong. And I like my world organized like that.
Yes. Yes. What you're getting on here is what has been found is that conservatives have less tolerance for uncertainty and ambiguity. So what happens after we die? People on the left are more okay with, I don't know, and people on the right want more of an answer. And that's, again, it's very easy to empathize with that. And conservatives have a greater need for order and structure. Religion provides that. But the other one is that it seems to me that conservatives like to know their place more. And this is an opinion. This is my extrapolation based off of everything that I've read in the political psychology literature, that because of that need for structure and order, that conservatives like to know where they are in the totem pole. And I think that religion helps provide that. When it comes to authoritarianism, big time links between authoritarianism and religiosity. It's perhaps not too surprising. People that believe in a celestial dictator also believe more frequently in terrestrial dictators.
Because they're either consciously or subconsciously, they're a little bit more, they've been exposed to that idea before in a very positive spin kind of way.
Yeah. And I think when it comes to political psychology for everyone, this is not just conservatives, this is just you and me too, man. I think a lot of it's subconscious. I don't think too many people, and it disappoints me, but I don't think too many people think really deeply about this kind of stuff. I think a lot of people are just going about living their lives, taking care of their kids, going to their job, going to the grocery store. I made my point.
It's not only that we're all busy, it's these aren't necessarily fun subjects to think about.
True. Right? Yes, true.
It's unpalatable. A lot of it. But I can see...
Most humans don't like harsh truths.
Never have.
I don't like them either. I'm not special and above it.
But I can see, because kids tend to follow their parents. So I can see that if a kid is brought up from the age of zero as a religious person, that is already starting those brain channels to start forming even at that young age.
Yes. And on top of that, religion also gives people community. A lot of people, like especially if you live in a small town, what other community groups are there? And I've found that if something works for somebody, they're probably not going to question it too much. It's why the rich people are conservative, overwhelmingly. Right. System works for them. They want to keep it the same.
So I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that you voted for Bernie in both 2016 and 2020 in the primaries.
Oh, yeah, big time. I was a really big activist for Bernie, especially in 2020.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Can I share something?
Yes.
Maybe a little bit embarrassing. No. In my town, I live in a town of about 80,000 people. And we got like street fairs and stuff like that. And I would dress up like Bernie with like a bald cap. And for anyone just listening, okay, like I have long hair. So I'm like stuffing the hair into this bald cap, going around like hunchbacked, wearing a suit, doing all of his hand wavy motions. And I part of the autism is I'm really good at memorizing audio. So I have a really good capacity to repeat all of his talking points, and Bernie has a very good capacity to repeat his own talking points, so it makes it pretty easy. And one of the events I did was we got like 100 people for the 4th of July. We had this huge parade. You can look it up. The Alameda, California 4th of July parade. It's one of the biggest in the country. We got 80,000 people in a town of 80,000 people to come out. And we hooked up two speakers in a little car. And they gave me a microphone, and I'm leading the whole thing, doing all of his talking points. It was one of the most fun experiences I've ever had. But yeah, I can't, hundreds of doors I knocked on. I learned how to sneak into a lot of apartment buildings from there.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Bernie. Yeah, Bernie's my hero, man. I'm further to the left than Bernie, but like Bernie, I believe in electoralism. I believe in maximizing positive outcomes. I am not one of those lefties who's like, I'm not going to vote for Democrats. I really hate that mindset. If voting for Joe Biden only saved 10 people versus Donald Trump, it would be worth voting just to save those 10 lives. And with Bernie, I think he was a once-in-a-lifetime kind of candidate. I really think that it's sad for America that we missed out on our Abraham Lincoln, on our Franklin Roosevelt.
So what do you say to that, to the Bernie bro trope?
The data shows that Bernie supporters voted overwhelmingly for the Democratic candidate. I think it's a bit unfair. It's unfair, first off, because in 2020, white men were not exactly the primary voter for Bernie. So this is a problem with the race and sex connotation to saying Bernie bro. But to the people that were Bernie or bust, I just disagree with them. I think that they're wrong. I think that having another Trump presidency is an existential threat to the democracy of this country. I think that too many of the Bernie or bust people, small as they are in population, they overrate the level of authoritarianism in our country. I have many criticisms of America, what it does to other countries, what it does to its people, but we are not an authoritarian state. And I think to say that we are an authoritarian state, that we are a fascist state, that Trump, we're already a fascist state, what's the problem with having more Trump? I think those people severely underrate the authoritarianism that is possible out there in the world.
Yeah, I think his 4 years showed that we're not necessarily as far away from it as we thought we were.
Yes, but also that we aren't fully there yet, and that there is a really big difference. There is a huge difference between living in the United States and living in Russia or China or even hybrid regimes like Turkey.
Right, right.
But America is a flawed democracy. The democracy indexes that I've seen have America not in a full democracy, but as flawed democracy. So we can do a lot better, but we ain't authoritarian.
So what would you do if you were king for a day, speaking of...
I was the supreme leader. Yeah. Supreme leader alien perspective.
What would you do to fix democracy in America?
So many things. So I'm a big fan of proportional representation. So one of the things I studied was voting systems. I'm just such a nerd. I actually studied voting systems. Mm-hmm. So proportional representation, if you don't know, if a political party gets 10% of the vote, they get 10% of the seats. So I live in California. If the Ceasefire Now party got 10% of the vote, they would get 5 seats in the House of Representatives for California. I would love for that to be implemented. For the Senate, I would like to see proportional representation for the whole country, or just abolish the Senate. Either way, that works for me. Sadly, all of these changes would require a constitutional amendment, so I ain't holding my breath. Another thing I would want to see is mandatory voting. I think everyone under a certain age, after a certain age, you can become disabled, or maybe dementia can be a factor. Maybe after 65 or after 60 or after 70, I don't know what the age cutoff would be, but below that age, you should have to vote. However, I think that one of the options should be none of these people. I don't want any of these people to represent me. And if none of these people wins, then the people who were nominated don't get to run again.
Wow. Okay.
I would also like to see...
Go ahead.
Oh, go for it. A couple little things. Automatic voter registration. Other countries do it. This is not difficult. And then Election Day would be a holiday. That's got to be a must.
I heard there are a couple of really authoritarian sort of sounding comments, right? In terms of you have to go vote. Isn't that very thing just antithetical to the concepts of American freedom?
Maybe. And maybe that's a totally fair criticism. Now, when it comes to mandatory voting, technically speaking, all you have to do is go to the polling location, pick out your ballot, and if you want to wipe your ass with it and then throw it in the garbage, like, that's your freedom. But when it comes to mandatory voting, I'm not saying throw them in prison. I'm saying, you know, a little fine. That's how South American countries have done it. Australia implemented mandatory voting. I think that we're all part of society and we should all be part of society. And if you want to throw away your vote, literally throw away your vote, that's fine. If you want to vote for none of these people, that's your right too.
So
I think it will maximize positive outcomes. Like, I maybe this is an autism thing. My patriotism is to people, not necessarily to the ideals of my country. I think that mandatory voting would increase the level of freedom and democracy and human well-being in this country. So that's why I'm for it.
But you've seen the average American.
Yep.
And you want more of the average American voting.
Yep. Okay. I don't think that just because the average American can be ignorant, can whatever negative thing you want to say about the average American, I want everyone to be represented.
Okay. All right. Even if it means, because I think that sort of makes us a little bit more susceptible to populism. No?
Okay.
And so even if...
It definitely would.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I will say, though, out of the people that don't vote, like, just from a selfish perspective, like, our ideas, like, we would get more of our ideas in there. Because out of the people that don't vote, they are disproportionately liberal-leaning.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Don't overrate this, right? The people that don't vote overwhelmingly are very ignorant, don't know really anything about politics, but out of the people that aren't totally oblivious, they do, on average, more left-leaning, because on average, the people that don't vote are poor. They're people that feel disenfranchised. They're people that feel that the government doesn't represent them, doesn't do anything for them, is a distant, far-off representation of corporate power. And maybe they don't see it necessarily in those terms, but that's like the general vibe.
Okay.
I can't believe I actually just cited a vibe. Considering all of the academic research papers I cite in my work, I just went with a vibe.
At least you didn't say conservative gives you the ick. So
it's true.
That all.
That's true.
But Israel, for instance, has proportional representation, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Even though
I think that's right, yeah.
They limit who actually can vote and who they can vote for. But we are so used to the dual party system here that I think it would take decades for us to get over trying to form governments, for instance.
Yeah. Oh, it would take a constitutional amendment to do proportional representation, and that's not going to happen. That is just the politicians who get their seat. That's just not going to happen. You asked me, Fantasyland, Keegan is the God King. I don't have any hope of that happening. I don't have any hope of that happening. The more reasonable things that we could accomplish would be making Election Day a holiday, automatic voter registration. Those would be the two big ones that are totally achievable.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I think, and sorry, I'm bouncing around here a bit, but
that's okay.
I think I've been lucky enough to work on a couple of political campaigns at the congressional level. And the best thing I really ever heard and changed my way of thinking was on the first campaign where a very much more mature, experienced person said to me that it's a cliche, but perfect is the enemy of good. And I think, like, when you're talking about people who are not going to vote for Biden at all because of his lack of action on Gaza, you so want things to be perfect that you're not able to grasp the good.
Yes, 100% agree. I think that we need to think about things in terms of, like, it literally, if voting for Joe Biden saves one life, it's worth voting for Joe Biden over Donald Trump. And Joe Biden's presidency will save a lot more lives than just one person, on top of American democracy and all the ramifications of that going forward. So here's what I would say to anyone who's like a radical lefty bro that's not going to vote for Joe Biden, is you have to accept we weren't born at the right time. We were not born at the right time. A lot of our ideas will be implemented in the future. 100 years from now, people will look at Bernie Sanders and go, how did they not go for that guy? In the same way that today we can look back on the pro-slavery people and go, what the fuck? And so we just have to accept we weren't born at the right time. And that doesn't make us better. That's an important understanding. But it means that we have to work within the reality that we live in, not the reality that we want to achieve. We have to try to achieve something for future generations, because it's just not going to happen for us. And I know selfishly we all want it. We all have that sense of urgency. But it's probably not going to happen anytime soon. We have to maximize good outcomes rather than try to achieve perfect outcomes.
And a large portion of that is simply shifting the Overton window further left.
Yeah. Yes. And we only get that if we participate. If people like me don't vote, Democrats aren't going to listen to us. The Democrats aren't sitting around going, but you know what? Those Ralph Nader voters in 2000, we got to really warm up to them and win them over. That never happened. That will never happen. The only way that we get more political power is by participating, as frustrating as it is. And it is not the same as, I'm going to work for an oil company, but be one of the good guys. This is not the same as that. I've seen that analogy so many times, and I just can't stand it. People on the low, there are so many people that have been activated by Bernie Sanders that are now on the local, city, county level, and it is changing the Democratic Party. It's slower than I want. Mike, it's probably slower than you want, but it's better than no change whatsoever. People's lives are at stake. I really wish more people thought about the people's lives are at stake. And if it's just one person, it's worth it.
I won't get into the, I won't debate that specific point. I think there's a lot of things that might save some lives that are not worth the effort. But I think I'm a little more cynical than yourself. I firmly believe that none of it matters anymore. All that matters now is money. The Democrats won't care about a million potential voters as opposed to one guy and give them $100 million.
Yeah.
Are you not?
I don't have any way of disagreeing with that one.
Okay.
I just have no way of disagreeing with
that.
It's just true.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's the society we live in. And hey, listen, you compare, oh my God, anyone that knows anything about like the 1880s and 1890s, we're less corrupt than we were then. So there's more hope.
Yeah, you're thinking Tammany Hall, teapot scandal.
That's one example. Yes, absolutely. Dude, the Republicans, who at the time in the 1870s were the liberal party that also had a little radical wing to it, and the Democrats were the conservative and right-wing authoritarian party, the Republicans just gave up on Reconstruction in order to take the presidency in a corrupt bargain. Like, what horrible ramifications, especially to Black people in the South, did that decision have? They did it for political power, and we don't see anything quite that bad these days. Fortunately.
So you're optimistic.
Very, yeah. Don't get me wrong. I think that the climate crisis is going to wreak havoc on our entire species, and it's going to increase the risk of nuclear war. It's going to increase the risk of famine. There's a city in South India called Chennai. It's got over 20 million people. It's going to run out of water at some point. What's that going to do? What's going to happen when multiple cities in India run out of water and they have nukes and Pakistan has nukes and they have religious conflict? Like, what's going to happen? So don't get me wrong. There's going to be a lot of bad things that happen because of the climate emergency. But I think that it's very Marxist for me to think this, but I do see a continuous progress in a very big picture way. And I'm very optimistic about the future. I feel like I have to be. In order to maintain my sanity, perhaps.
The alternative's too bleak. Do you really think that climate change is, even, let's say, Chennai, like, we don't handle refugees who come to us because of war, right, where they've been bombed out of their home, literally. We don't do a good job of processing or handling those people, let alone people that are like, my house flooded. I feel in some times that globally the West is starting to reach the limits of its empathy as is without introducing additional potential problems.
we don't handle it at our southern border. There's a bunch of people who are also climate refugees. It's not just people escaping violence, such as drug gang violence. There's also people, it's my farm, it's not producing the crops. I got to go ahead to another opportunity, and that's only going to get worse. And going into the future, it's really hard to know, because it's hard to know how much the impact of the internet will have on the level of empathy. It's pretty clear to me that the younger generations have a divide with the older generations, not just because lead is no longer in the gasoline, but because we have the internet, and that creates a lot of open-mindedness. It obviously gives us access to more data to know what's actually true or not true. We don't have TV gatekeeping us as much. But because we're able to interact with people from other countries, makes people more progressive, makes people more open-minded. And I would hope that in the future that translates to more pro-immigrant views, because every bit of data shows that immigrants are neutral at worst for our economy. But typically speaking, immigrants are good for our economy. They're good for wages. They're good for our culture. And I would hope that feeling greater amounts of threat because of the climate emergency will be overwhelmed by the increase in empathy, the increase in open-mindedness that happens because of the internet.
And I know we're running long, and I want to be respectful of your time.
I'm happy to talk for 5 hours.
Careful.
Longer than anyone should be reasonably okay with.
Please, let's make sure there are bathroom breaks involved.
Okay.
But I would tell you, I guess I would say in part among the youth, I think there's a feeling or a perception that the youth of today are a little bit indoctrinated, a little bit fascistic, to be honest, when it comes to rights, climate change, freedom of speech, contrary ideas, right?
Yeah. Is that the stereotype?
I think it exists out there for sure. The thought that you can't, the universities specifically are no longer just complete. You can absolutely say just whatever. The whole, I hate what you're saying, but I will die for your right to say it, doesn't seem to be trickling down generationally. No, you're not.
Perhaps that's true. I'm sure that's true for certain. It's obviously true for certain people. But overall, oh man, here's what we're seeing right now. I was listening to your previous podcast, and you guys were talking about polarization, and I was like, ooh, what's the psychology spinoff of this? And what we're seeing right now is that overall, the younger generation is more progressive. There are more progressive people there are, as a percentage, and those progressive people are more progressive than people of previous generations, right? However, what we're also seeing is that authoritarianism is not dropping off.
Yeah,
people on the right, about over half of them now have an authoritarian personality. I'm referencing a Morning Consult survey that Bob Altmaier, the leading researcher on right-wing authoritarianism, called the gold standard. 25% of Americans have a right-wing authoritarian personality. So what we're seeing is that it's not... So what we're seeing is on the right, people are concentrating more and more into the far right, the authoritarian right, the fascist right. And what the increase in progressives is taking away from more moderate conservatives. I hope that was comprehensible.
That we're generationally shifting left.
Slowly. Yes, overall, on average. However, the people on the right are shifting further right as well.
So I'm just going to, again, throw a thought out there. I think the current generation, isn't fascism without an authoritarian figure just groupthink?
Absolutely, yeah. That's a major component of it, yes. But also, there's an anti-intellectualism with fascism. I don't like throwing out the word fascism. Just authoritarianism is the broad category. Fascism is a specific kind of authoritarianism. It happens to be very popular now in industrialized societies. So it's anti-intellectual, racist, backward views on... traditional views on gender, hatred of gay and trans people. You can be authoritarian and not necessarily have those things. Oh, and fascism, a huge component, is hyper-corporatism and hyper-nationalism.
And violence.
And violence, absolutely. I would say that's true, broadly speaking, of authoritarianism. This kind of fear of the others. Oh man, wonderful quote. This is from a piece called Alienation and Empathy as Mediators of the Relation Between Social Dominance Orientation, Right-Wing Authoritarianism, and Expressions of Racism and Sexism by Nickel and Rounding. Here's the quote. Right-wing authoritarianism as a worldview suggests that the world is a dangerous place, something to be feared, respecting the status quo, following the rules of society, respecting aggressive acts approved by authority figures are believed necessary to control the frightening and unpredictable elements of society. Nailed it. Hence the violent tendencies.
Was there anything to understand where you're going? And I understand how it's completely different, but I think a lot of people would say, and, right? What was in there that was so bad? The world is a scary, dangerous place. Or they feel that way, right? I think there's a lot of people that would listen to that quote and just be like, okay, yeah.
Authoritarianism doesn't make the world a safer place. Authoritarian countries are more dangerous. They're more dangerous to the citizenry. They're less empathetic towards their own citizens. They start more wars. Authoritarianism is just not good. If you want to feel safer, I don't know, decreasing war and crime would be the two ways to go. And the way to decrease crime is by minimizing poverty, but more so minimizing income inequality.
Right.
So authoritarianism, right-wing authoritarianism, is not going to make our education system better, which would decrease poverty and crime. It's not going to decrease crime. It's just going to try to clamp down on crime, which doesn't lower crime. We saw that with the war on drugs. We saw it with the policing policies of the Ronald Reagan administration. And yet crime went up and peaked during Reagan and George H.W. Bush. It's not a coincidence that we've seen a record decrease in homicides under Joe Biden. And that didn't happen under Donald Trump. Under Trump, it's hate crimes that actually went up massively. So authoritarianism just does not make the world a safer place.
If you look over the last, I think, 50 years in terms of the economic performance of the country under Democratic presidents versus Republican presidents, it's like literally night and day, right?
Yes. And yes, it is.
In terms of
with Eisenhower being an exception because he was the most liberal Republican we've had since Theodore Roosevelt, arguably William Howard Taft, but Eisenhower ran on like increasing Social Security and unionization and stuff like that. Yeah, it's crazy. I would encourage anyone, look up average increase in GDP by president and you will be blown away. The like Trump, it was like the worst performance since the Great Depression. On jobs, Trump was the worst performance since the Great Depression. God. And you look at the Democratic presidents and it's like massive growth under Lyndon Johnson, massive growth under Franklin Roosevelt, and unemployment. The quality of jobs is also very important. Trump could brag for the first 3 years about the low unemployment rate, but first off, you could argue he was riding off Obama's coattails. Every economist will tell you that the first couple of years of a presidency is really off riding off the coattails of the previous presidency, but it's also the quality of the jobs, and the quality of the jobs are just better under more liberal and progressive presidents. And we're seeing that under Biden.
Why is it such an ingrained thought that the general zeitgeist of people is that Republicans are better financially? That's the thing, right?
It's so frustrating, isn't it? I think obviously a big part of it is the media. The media is large, like big media. The people who are on your television are very wealthy people. They benefit from more conservative policies. I'm sure that's a factor. Part of it is that our schools don't teach people this kind of stuff. They don't teach people the history of conservatives were for this, liberals were for this at this point in history, and this is the effect that it had. Because they're so afraid of coming off liberal, having a liberal bias. Yeah. Sorry, but the facts have a liberal bias when it comes to the economy. There are so many factors, man. A part of it's just Democrats just are not very good at campaigning. They're not very good at representing themselves, particularly on the economy. Listen, Trump, for as many horrible qualities as he has, during his presidency, he was constantly campaigning for himself. He was constantly trying to pump himself up. How much of the stuff that he said was true? It's Trump. But you know, Joe Biden...
It took him 3 years.
Joe Biden is unable to, or is unwilling to go out and really rep himself constantly. And maybe that's because he's doing the job of the presidency. But to a certain extent, the president needs to be an in-your-face public figure, constantly campaigning for their ideas. I would say more than anything, the president needs to use the bully pulpit. And it's one of the reasons why Franklin Roosevelt was such a wonderful president.
So just taking all the psychology and all of it and putting it in a blender and all the intellectual political science behind all the theories, does it really boil down to Republicans are dicks and Democrats are pussies from whatever libertarian spew that was? But is there
I don't disagree with that. It is true that people on the left have a greater scope of empathy. So there's this idea that people on the right have less empathy, but I think about it more in terms of scope of empathy, not capacity for empathy. So here's what I mean by that. Somebody who's a Republican, who's a conservative, will empathize just as well, but it's just for people that are like them. People that grew up in the suburbs, or white people, or Christians, or men, or cisgender people, or whatever. Whereas, because people on the left are more open-minded, they're more open to different people's experience, perspective, way of looking at things. And so they're better able to understand somebody who's different from them. And if you're able to understand someone who's different from you, you're better able to empathize. But I think that what it really comes down to is that conservatives prioritize coping with their fears, mm-hmm. and people on the left, the goal is more about maximizing positive outcomes.
Even
the right is more about, the right is more about avoiding negativity, and the left is more about promoting positivity.
Yeah. And I guess, for me, I still feel like a healthy balance of those two is required for the optimal society. Like, again, I'm old, so I can, the days where there were Democrats and Republicans, and the difference between them was that they just had different ways of how they would go about managing the country, or their priorities were a little bit different. It wasn't, and that's why I think you see so much collaboration between the parties and the voting records from 1900 odd on, that we don't have today. And I still feel like that helped make us, those two bodies, the marketplace of ideas, really helped the country. And I am worried about what happens when we don't have that, when it's just a completely lopsided situation. But you're okay with it. You're okay with 20 years of progressive rule.
Yeah, I would totally be okay with 20 years of progressive rule. Yeah, zero problem with that for me. I just see it as an inevitable outcome that American politics polarizes. We are not any more polarized than we were in 1860. I'm not convinced we were any more polarized than we were in 1800 with the election of Thomas Jefferson over John Adams. We fluctuate between these periods of less polarization and more polarization. And the assumption with the older generations is that, wow, this polarization is crazy. And it's because they grew up at a time of actually the lowest degree of polarization in American history, which was the 40s through the 60s.
Right.
I just see it as an inevitable outcome. And listen, if there were conservative ideas that produced good outcomes, I'd be 100% for them. I am very data and empiricism driven. I don't have an emotional attachment to certain ideas. I will change my views if you convince me that the data and the facts line up otherwise. But there just isn't data and facts that lines up with X conservative idea is better than X progressive idea.
So let's wrap up with one of those that I think potentially might be in there. So
we've
heard the word transphobia quite a bit, and it's a particularly sensitive subject these days. Can you understand why there is some of that backlash against trans rights or incorporating trans genders people into the overall? Do you get where they're coming from there, or is it just alien to you?
I better get it, because I'm working on a video right now. I'm editing a YouTube video right now on the psychology of transphobia. So I better understand it, or else I'm not doing a good video. So there's certain levels of empathy that you got to give to the transphobe. If they haven't been introduced to pro-trans ideas, I can get why it's scary. If you imagine your dick getting cut off, like, that's a scary thing. That will trigger the fear part of your brain. It triggers the fear part of my brain. Just a few years ago, before I was introduced to the data on trans healthcare especially, I didn't know how puberty blockers worked. I didn't know that puberty blockers are reversible. I didn't know that the hormone therapy, to actually get on puberty blockers and hormone therapy, you have to spend years and years with doctors and psychologists and professionals on this specific part of healthcare. I didn't know any of that. I didn't know that the rate of regret of bottom surgery is less than 1%. I looked at other surgeries like hip surgery or knee surgery, and all the surgeries that I could find, they had a regret rate of like 10 to 25%. And then cosmetic surgery, it's way higher.
But not,
but on the bottom surgery for trans people was less than 1% in a large meta-analytical sample size. If you don't know those things, it's very easy to be afraid of them. It's very easy to be afraid of the unknown.
I say we loosely, there's this constant drip of they're mutilating children's bodies. I saw something from the response to the State of the Union about, and again, and I think in even in my head, I have this idea of this super liberal, super hippie family that has a kid who's five and just has a phase where she is acting tomboyish or he's acting feminine. And they just, whether it's through virtue signaling, which I do think is a thing, or just misguided best intentions, they roll with it, or they, in fact, even wind up pushing it farther than it probably would have naturally gone if they had just let it run its course. Or is that?
Again, it's easy to fall into these lines of thinking, but that's just not how it works. So if we saw that, what we'd see in the data is a really high regret rate amongst people that went on puberty blockers. But most of the data shows it's less than 5%, if not 2, 3, 1%. We would see regret rates that were higher for the hormone therapy, which is the next step after puberty blockers. If you don't know that puberty blockers are reversible, which they are, to make this clear, like, if you're on puberty blockers, you don't go on them until you actually start puberty. There's no six-year-old going on puberty blockers. No doctor would do that. Do no harm. Like, Hippocratic Oath, they can't do that. There's a lot of gatekeeping, right? You have to get on puberty blockers. You have to spend at least a year talking with doctors and psychologists and specialists on this stuff. They don't just like, here's some puberty blockers. Like, that just does not happen. And it doesn't happen before age 11, 12, 13, typically. But they're also totally reversible. If you are on puberty blockers from age 11 to 16 and you go off them because you're like, you know what? I think that the sex that I was born with, I don't want to alter that. You go off the puberty blockers and then puberty hits you like a freight train. And there's just no long-term side effects. We have been using puberty blockers for over 40 years. We have a lot of data on this from early onset puberty, what they're previously used for. The overwhelming medical consensus is that seeing doctors, seeing psychologists for a long time, consulting with parents, making sure that there is a pattern of gender dysphoria, gender nonconforming behavior, then going on puberty blockers, then going on hormone therapy, and then only about 25% of people actually have the bottom surgery, and nobody under 18 is having bottom surgery. Doctors know a lot more than I do, and the overwhelming medical consensus on trans healthcare aligns with what I just listed out. So I don't have the arrogant smugness to think that I know more than thousands and thousands of doctors and psychologists. They're correct. And we would see more harm if there was actually harm being done.
I think it's a good example of that whole empathy overcoming initial disgust kind of thing.
Yes.
Or maybe not.
Yes.
Disgust isn't the right word, but fear.
Look, we don't want to admit. I personally feel like gross saying like, transphobia is largely about oversensitivity to disgust, because I don't want a trans person to hear that and feel, oh, these people think I'm disgusting. But you got to get real, like, every trans person already knows this. And to sugarcoat it is to just be bullshitting ourselves. Oversensitivity to disgust is the core, along with fear of the unknown, of homophobia and transphobia.
And so what do you say to the parents whose children are in sporting events competing against trans athletes?
There's 5 trans athletes in the country. I don't know. I think there's bigger problems. I don't know. Have bigger concerns, man. Like, we were talking about healthcare earlier. Like, 70,000 people could be saved by going to Medicare for All. I think that legislating on healthcare is a bit more important than legislating on freaking trans athlete whateverness. Like, you have to have 3 years of hormone therapy, puberty blockers to compete. Like, that's fine. But I don't know. There's part of me that's, can we just get rid of the gender distinctions within sports anyway? But I just, like,
the physio,
this is not causing any harm, man. If you're that concerned about high school sports, like, I don't know, man, have more faith in your kids. Like, your kids are stronger than you think. Ah, man, kids are underrated. The strength of kids and the intelligence of kids, I really think, is underrated. And I think that a kid can handle losing to a trans athlete. I just think they can handle it.
Okay. Did you play sports in high school?
I did. We still play sports. I baseball.
Okay. Wow. All right.
Yeah.
Cool. Good answer. See, I'm learning stuff here.
Hey, I'm glad to hear it. That's awesome. Great.
So we like to wrap up the shows. And again, I thank you for your time. I know we went over. I really appreciate it.
Hey, I thank you for your time. This has been a great experience. I will always remember this. This was a really positive experience.
But we like to wrap
up. Oh, you're blushing. That's really sweet. Mm. To anyone just listening, he is blushing.
I knew I should not have bought this webcam. So we like to ask our guests the last question, which is, have you ingested any sort of media lately that you think the audience should know about, whether it's music, a book, play, TV, anything, a YouTube channel? Is there anything that you think more people should know about?
What a great question. I would recommend as a news source, Democracy Now! To everyone. Listen, my autistic ability to concentrate on just one thing for hours and hours will be shown right here. I found a lo-fi remix of the Evenstar song from The Lord of the Rings, and I swear I've listened to it for about 9 hours in the last 3 days. So I'd really recommend going onto YouTube, type in lo-fi, L-O-F-I, Evenstar. Oh my God, put in some earbuds, you'll hear some magic.
Perfect. That's perfect. Let's talk about your YouTube channel for just a second. Where can people find you? Are you on X or Threads, or what's your presence there?
I am not on X, Twitter. I'm not on Threads. I technically have accounts at Keegan Tatum, K-E-E-G-A-N-T-A-T-U-M, but go on to TikTok. TikTok is the big one. Instagram, I also have an Instagram presence. It's Keegan Tatum on both of those platforms. And then on YouTube, it's called Alien Perspective, and it's like half of my face and then half of an alien face. And on my YouTube channel, I do post all of my content that I post on TikTok. I post a lot of YouTube shorts, but the advantage of YouTube is that you have the very long form videos where I'll talk for 25 minutes on why old people are more conservative and the psychology behind that. And eventually, hopefully this month, will be the psychology of transphobia. Awesome. As well as I just released a video on the symptoms of authoritarianism. So if you're interested in the MAGA personality, that's the video for you.
Yeah, I think I've moved past trying to understand them, which is sad, but there it is. That's my failing. All right.
Listen, a lot of people are TFG, man. They're too far gone. But some people aren't. But more importantly, it's just interesting. It is just interesting to know what's going on in their head because they're just so different. They think in a fundamentally different way than you. And I think that's fascinating.
Absolutely. Keegan, it's been a great hour. I really appreciate it. Please, let's try and do this again sometime. And thank you very much. And it's Alien Perspectives, plural, on YouTube.
No, not plural. Just Alien Perspective.
Are you sure? Because when I was looking for you, there was a music group called Alien Perspective.
There is. And they're higher than me when you search for them. So everyone got to search and subscribe to me so that I'm the number one person. It's just Alien Perspective, singular. Yeah.
Got it. All right. Cool, Key. Thanks again. I really appreciate your time.
Hey, this was a wonderful experience, Mike. I'm so glad to have been invited on. Thank you so much. I hope you have a lovely day.
I'm holding out hope. How's that?
You're holding out hope for today?
Yeah.
It's almost 6:30 where I'm at, so I don't know how much more of this day there is before you.
All right, Keegan, thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.